Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Have a chance to talk to you.
I'm surprised you have time to sleep and eat. Yeah, you'll do it during the interview, which will be great. So I have to ask my first question. I know that you are a connoisseur of David Merrick stories. Do you have a favorite Merrick story that you'd like to share with us?
I absolutely have a favorite Merrick story. It is told, and I may be, if people want to find the source, Harvey Sabinson, who was for many years Merrick's press agent, and later when I knew him much later, was the head of the New York Theater League, the Broadway Theater League, and now is retired, wrote a memoir called, I think it was called Darling, You Are Wonderful. Anyway, this may be a slightly garbled version, but it's absolutely priceless. Of course, it involved Subways Over Sleeping, which was, I alas never saw. I was about 10 or 11, 12 years old when this happened. But it's famous to most people because of a prank that Merrick did, which was in the days of 7 New York daily newspapers, he had been waiting to find a show for which he could hire essentially 7 people with the same names as the New York drama critics and take a fake quote ad with all of them raving the show. And he couldn't, he was stymied for years because the most important drama critic of that day, Brooks Atkinson, at the New York Times, had a one-of-a-kind name. He could never find a Brooks Atkinson. but when Atkinson retired, he was succeeded by a critic named Howard Taubman. And so the roster was complete, and Merrick, this is it's been much told, found the 7 people, took them out to a steak dinner, to a preview of Subways for Sleeping, had them sign onto a quote ad with quotes like, makes My Fair Lady look like junk, you know, not merely the best musical of the season, the best musical of the century. And it was a Julie Stein, a Betty Comden, Adolf Green, lesser known, lesser show with Sidney Chaplin and Carol Lawrence and Phyllis Newman. It was mediocre, and he placed the ad to run the morning after the opening in the Times and the Herald Tribune. The Times caught the ad and yanked it before the first edition. The Tribune didn't. It ran for one edition, which is all he needed. Then they pulled it when they discovered it was a hoax. It made front pages all over the world, and this mediocre show, which got lousy reviews, ran for a season and almost made its money back. However, that's not the story. The less famous story is about the same show. It tried out in Philadelphia, the Forest Theater in Philadelphia. It got terrible reviews. Sabinson, as Merrick's press agent, was dispatched to Boston. The next stop was going to be the Colonial Theater in Boston to drum up feature coverage in the newspapers for it. And Sabinson goes to Boston, comes back to Philadelphia and said, I placed the piece. But by the way, the first string critic of the Boston Globe isn't covering the show. And Merrick said, what do you mean? And he's sending a second stringer, Kevin Kelly, would later become the chief critic there. And clearly, Merrick says, well, clearly he heard the reviews in Philadelphia, and that's why he's covering something else instead, more important than this. He said, I've got an idea. And the idea was, we will ban this second stringer, Kevin Kelly, from the opening in Boston and get publicity. And so a couple of weeks pass. They go up to Boston. It's a snowy night. And Kevin Kelly, having been told that he was being barred from the theater, turns up at the theater, and this ritual before local news and local TV, he's turned away into the night in the snow by Merrick. And they say, why won't you let him cover the show? He said, because he's a second stringer and he's an idiot. the next morning, so the show opens without Kevin Kelly. The next morning, Merrick is in his suite at the Ritz in Boston. Sabinson walks in with the papers and said, David, you're a genius. You were on the front page of the Boston Globe, all about how you barred Kevin Kelly from the theater, and there's a sidebar by Kevin Kelly, what it was like to be barred by David Merrick. And he said, but David, sit down. The best is yet to come. You go inside to the Jump, and there's a review of Subways Over Sleeping by Kevin Kelly. And Merrick says, what do you mean? He said, well, he wrote an introduction saying, knowing he was going to be banned, he bought a ticket to the last performance in Philadelphia and reviewed it on the basis of that. And he says, and Saban says, and David, it is a rave. to which Merrick says, didn't I say he was an idiot?
Oh my God.
That's a great story.
I've not heard that.
That's a great story, yeah. It's one of the, there's so many great stories. Alas, my own career as a drama critic barely intersected with Merrick's. I reviewed his last real show, 42nd Street, at the beginning of my career, but that was it, essentially. I had some innings with him, but he was soon a stroke victim and out of the picture.
Right.
Have you ever thought about writing a book on Merrick?
Mm-mm. There's a not very good biography that was done of him. I wouldn't want to write a biography of anyone. I also don't think there's the material to sustain. Yeah. I think he's absolutely fascinating. But the one obituary I wrote for the Times, the entire time I was there, was of Merrick. It was his front page obituary. That story isn't in it, but tons of other stories are. I really poured my heart and soul into it with a fondness. I mean, I didn't know him. I met him. But a sort of a appreciation for what he represented. It's long gone, even then, in the theater. And I'm sure you can just find it in the Times archive if you search for my name and David Merrick and obituary. It was a front page. It was quite a lengthy obituary. So it was a mini biography of him.
Right.
Great. Then we will post that for our listeners. I have to ask you, who was Clayton Coutts?
Clayton Coutts was a guy I met. A little bit of background, and I should say that much of this story I've told both in my memoir, Ghostlight, and in a subsequent piece about Clayton that I wrote for a New York magazine a few years ago. When I was a teenager growing up in D.C., Washington was a huge tryout town in the days when there really were routinely Broadway tryouts, you know, something that barely exists now because it was essentially replaced by previews in New York when it became too expensive to do it and when shows became also too heavy to just jump from city to city. So Washington was on the circuit that included Philadelphia, Boston and New Haven in particular. And I went there so many times as an adolescent buying standing room and second balcony seats to see shows that were trying out that and touring in some cases. The manager took pity on me and became and gave me a job as a ticket taker on Saturday matinees, which I did through high school, essentially, before going off to college. And it was an incredible period because it was the period of, you know, I saw shows try out like Fiddler and The Odd Couple and Hello Dolly and, you know, also big flops like Irving Berlin's Mr. President.
Oh, yeah.
Strange things like Peter Brook's The Physicist, all of that came through Washington. Part of my job, besides taking tickets, was in the days of hard tickets, pre-computer, sorting them by price range and sitting in a back office behind the orchestra floor of the theater, what was called the count, where essentially the manager of the theater and the company manager of the touring production would do the receipts of the day and settle, who was owed what. The company managers were by and large Damon Runyon types, old theater types, wonderful characters who toured for years. But occasionally there'd be someone who was younger, and Clayton Coutts was one, and he befriended me. I got to know a number of them, but I particularly we really hit it off. He was probably 15 years older than I was. through a fluke, I saw him. He came through with a touring company of the First National Company of Barefoot in the Park with Myrna Loy. I remember playing the mother.
Oh wow!
He was about to go and sit down for a year in Chicago with the First National Company of the Odd Couple, under the same management, obviously. And I was going to Chicago the summer after my junior year to go into a journalism summer program for high school students at Northwestern. I sort of had a girlfriend that came out of that program who actually lived in Chicago, and I was able to keep visiting her during my senior year of high school because my stepfather was an airline lawyer and I could get free plane tickets. And so Clayton was there. He said, you know, look me up. And my girlfriend and I spent a lot of time with him, and often we'd go out to dinner with him when I was in town. He'd do the count at the Blackstone Theater, where the Odd Couple was. It was a company with Richard Benjamin and Dan Daly, and then he'd take my friend and I out to dinner, and I'd often stay with him because her mother was she was a single mother and disapproving of the boyfriend, even in those sort of simpler times, staying in a close quarters in an apartment in the north side of Chicago. So he remained, and I remained friends with him, and had a correspondence with him until sort of the tail end of college. And then sort of we drifted away from each other. He drifted out of the theater, ultimately I would learn after the fact that he had died at a fairly young age. Mm. But he was a very influential figure on me, not so much even about the theater, but about life. Although I learned a lot, I felt the theater was very glamorous. He didn't really, but I didn't believe him. And you know, I saw a lot of the theater from the inside through his eyes, and he was just a kind of charming Pied Piper guy, very lovely, very interesting, very smart, very witty, from a sort of show business lineage. His father, who was then still alive, who I never met, was a songwriter named J. Fred Coots, who had made a lot of money writing in the 20s, particularly he wrote Santa Claus is Coming to Town to My Head, among other standards. And so he was sort of I was sort of an unhappy teenager. I had problems in my family. He became kind of a surrogate parent to me and just made me, you know, love the theater that much more that I could know someone like him. I thought was extremely glamorous. Yeah. And just great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. One of the things we love to do on this show is celebrate mentors. And it sounds like, so thank you for that. When did you realize that being a critic was a viable option for you in terms of a career path?
I really, it's weird because when I look back on it, of course, it's not really a viable career path for anybody. I mean, particularly now with what's happened in journalism, it's nothing you really aspire to do.
Yeah.
And in my case, I did a lot of it in college for the school paper, the Harvard Crimson, and again reviewing shows that were trying out. My senior year, Sondheim's Follies tried out at the Colonial in Boston, and I reviewed it for the school paper. Incredibly, a copy of it made its way to Follies, which is, I don't know how that happened actually, because it wasn't something you could buy in the newsstand in Boston at all. I mean, it was something, you know, distributed in Cambridge, but it led to Sondheim writing me a letter in the days of letters at the Crimson, that he was taken with my review, show had gotten mediocre reviews and worse in Boston, including from the aforementioned Kevin Kelly. This 10 years later, after Subway's Over Sleeping.
Right.
And I guess he didn't like it as much as Subway's Over Sleeping. I love the show. I had written about it, I guess, with a lot of passion. And so I got this letter from Sondheim asking to meet me. So I had a drink with him in Boston. And, of course, I was out of my mind that I was, you know, it was an incredibly nice thing of him to do.
He reached out to you.
I worshipped him. It gave me, feel, God, well, maybe I actually know something about this. But I didn't think I would be able to make a living at it. And even at the time on the Crimson, other people, other students, friends of mine on the paper saying, if you want to be a critic, you better start writing about movies because there's no interest in theater or theater criticism. And it was true. It was a declining industry at that time, and it wasn't something you'd do. In any case, it sort of planted the idea in my head that maybe I could do something with it. That said, I sold my first piece that summer. It was to Esquire. It had nothing to do with the theater. It was a piece about, I got an exclusive interview with Dan Ellsberg, who had just released the Pentagon Papers. I wrote a long profile of him for Esquire. And then I began a career that involved everything from sort of muckraking journalism in Virginia to writing film criticism, but mainly editing at a political magazine in New York, which is what brought me to New York. And I didn't have a work as a critic professionally for about another, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And I was a film critic at the New York Post and a film and television critic at Time. I didn't write a theater review professionally until I was hired by the Times in 1980. So it was 9 years after I'd written that review of Follies.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
That's a long period.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, but certainly that was a huge encouragement to me, but it had no direct effect on my career.
A very generic question, but what is the function of a critic? What do you feel that a critic should accomplish after a reader has finished reading the review?
Everyone may have a different idea about this. My idea was very simple, and it came entirely out of being a theater nut as a child. Growing up, not in New York, wanting to know everything about the theater, and while I was able to see a lot of shows as a kid in Washington, both touring and trying out, I didn't see most shows that I wanted to see in New York, because, you know, it was pre-Kennedy Center, Washington, and there was just one touring house, an arena stage, which at that time did almost entirely classics, not new plays.
Yeah.
What I loved about the critics that I discovered young, as a young reader, even, you know, I would say beginning at around 10 years old, 9 or 10 years old, were those that could make me see what I was missing, could bring with really good writing and some wit, bring to life for me in a way beyond photographs or Hirschfeld drawings or even original cast albums or play scripts, what it was like to be in the theater on a particular night and see that performance. And two critics in particular really did that for me. One was Walter Kerr, who was then with the Herald Tribune, and the other was Kenneth Tynan, who spent a year writing for The New Yorker. He was a British critic, obviously, but it was a year that happened to coincide with when I was falling in love with the theater. It was like the 59, 1960, 61 area. And I loved reading them, and it just gave me that. And as a result, that sort of became what I aspired to do as a critic, to give, because let's face it, many New York Times readers as a national paper were people like me. They were stranded elsewhere in the country where they didn't have access to every show that I was seeing. And I felt that was the most important thing, and the opinion expressed in the review was secondary. And I feel that, you know, no one agrees with a critic all the time. There'd be something wrong with you if you did. You get to know a critic's, you know, what you consider the critic's strengths and weak spots. You know, you might agree with this critic about performances or drama, but you might not agree with him or her about musicals or comedy or whatever.
Yeah.
And indeed, when I look back, my own taste and what I like in the theater, I would say that neither Tynan nor Kerr were as close to it as, say, Brooks Atkinson. Mm-hmm. But Atkinson was, to me, a much more pedestrian writer, and I read him, but it just didn't thrill me the way their pieces did. And so, so to me, it was about that. It was about trying to write and create that sensation the best I could. And also, in the terms of analysis, I always started with a gut reaction to whatever I saw. So if I was moved, or if I was bored, or I was angered, or I was made to laugh or to cry, I'd always start with that, and almost like solving a mystery about myself and about the play, try to figure out how I got to that reaction from what I saw and in the theater that night. So that's what I regarded as the assignment.
Because you were such a theater buff growing up, if you could go back in, you know, the good old time machine and attend a performance that you were not able to attend, what would it be?
I would have loved, I mean, I can't say a single performance. I think that's probably way too hypothetical. But I was actually, actually having a conversation with one of my sons just this weekend, sort of about this issue. He's someone who writes for show business, not in the theater. But,
right.
Unfortunately for him, saw a lot of bad theater as a child. I read. I really am taken by the period that I missed, the post-war period. I would have loved to have been alive and gone to the streetcar, salesman, South Pacific, Iceman Cometh. They all happened within a few years of each other after World War II. It's also a great period to be in New York City if you wanted to time travel, by all accounts.
Right. Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hey, podcast listeners, are you looking for a place to rehearse in New York City that is clean, spacious, and most importantly, affordable?
Come check out Shetler Studios and Theaters, our wonderful host for these podcasts. Shetler is centrally located on West 54th Street between Broadway and 8th Avenue, right in the heart of the theater district.
Right in the heart, you'll find music, dance, and acting studios, complemented by two black box theaters and six presentation venues. The professional facilities, inspired environment, and expert industry staff combine to provide the New York artist with an unparalleled studio experience.
Visit their website at ShetlerStudios.com. That's S-H-E-T-L-E-R Studios.com.
Shetler Studios and Theaters is our home for recording the legends of Broadway, and we hope that you make it your artistic home too.
That's Shetler, S-H-E-T-L-E-R Studios.com. See you here.
In terms of writing a review, is there anything that should be off limits for the critic to include in the review, such as if an actor was fired before the production was reviewed, or the fact that it might have taken, you know, 30 workshops for the show to actually get on stage? Is there anything that you feel is off limits in a review?
I really feel a lot of that background is irrelevant. Mm. I really do, and I feel I made a point, you know, not that I'm necessarily correct, but I made a point of not and it was easier pre-internet, of course, not knowing that stuff before a show opened, I wouldn't read Arts and Leisure advanced pieces about a show I was viewing in the Times. Nor would I look at a script in advance. I could always send for a script after I, seen something I was reviewing. I really, really felt it was important to have the experience of actually seeing the show without knowing the production history, gossip, what audiences were saying during previews, the out-of-town reviews. I felt that very strongly. I felt I wanted to recreate what I had as a child, which was to come in not knowing what was going to happen when the curtain went up and seeing something fresh. Mm. And I feel, the only time, if somebody died or something in previews that was replaced, you'd mention it. But, even when I was reviewing 42nd Street, where famously Merrick announced during the curtain call on opening night, the performance I attended, that Garrett Champion had died, the director and choreographer of the show, I originally didn't put it in my review. I felt it was irrelevant to considering the show, to which I had a very mixed reaction.
Right.
And then Arthur Gelb, the managing editor of the paper, said you really kind of have to put it in because it's a front page news story. You have to acknowledge that it happened.
Yeah.
And so I did at the very last minute. But that's how strongly I felt about it. In part because I felt that shouldn't influence one's judgment, which is what Merrick withheld, as we'd later learn, withheld the news of Champion, who died a day or two earlier, precisely to influence the critics. And I never wanted to be part of that game. And I feel now too many reviews I read where critics are reacting to the scuttlebutt, reacting what they heard about in previews, and that way lies madness. The classic example when I was reviewing was Sunday in the Park with George.
Mm.
You couldn't help but it was postponed two or three times, the opening, as they were working on it, which meant obviously things weren't going well because the date kept changing.
But I
hadn't seen a workshop. I didn't know anything about it beyond that it was about George Seurat. And when I went to see it, usually when critics go to a press performance, it's completely full of sycophants and friends and investors and family over-responding to everything gets a huge standing ovation and is wonderful. Because they'd had to postpone the opening so many times, one of the critics' nights, the one I attended, fell into what had been previously sold theater party. So they didn't have that kind of control over the house. And the audience didn't like it. And in fact, there were lots of walkouts. I loved the show. I was very moved by it. And I didn't let that influence me any more than I would have let all the gossip I'd learned after it opened about what was going on in previews influence me. But I'm telling you, a lot of critics who panned it, and most did, including Variety, for instance, had heard all the gossip, had been influenced by apparently negative response in previews, and I think the show's become a classic thing since. And I think the fact that everyone was absorbing all the scuttlebutt and whatever was messed up in the show in previews, it colored the reaction to the show. They wanted to be, sort of where the news was rather than judging the show on its own merits. And the critic is not a pollster. That's why I also feel never report audience response, because whatever it is, good, bad, or indifferent, it's going to be bogus in terms of what the show is.
When you were writing a review, did you have a certain structure that you would follow in the composition of the review?
Not really. I mean, I think anyone would say, or most critics who take it seriously would say, writing pieces, you probably want to lead with the strength of the production, even if it's not great, not a great show. You want to start by talking about what's good. And let's face it, most things you review are mixed. They're not great or terrible. But on the other hand, if something is really great or really awful, you probably begin with a feeling and an overall picture expressing that emotion.
One of the things we like to do on our show is celebrate artists that are no longer with us. And one of them you knew very well, and I would love to hear some memories or thoughts about Wendy Wasserstein, Frank.
Well, Wendy was someone that I loved. I met her before I was a drama critic, and I never reviewed her.
Right.
She was one of two friends that I had that were off. I signed other critics to review. What can I say? She was one of my best friends. She was someone who often went with me to see plays. She went with me and never asked what the show was. She's the one I saw Bruce Murders with.
Good friend.
Yeah.
And she was a funny, warm person. Her public persona was pretty much who she was. Lovely, generous to people, young people coming up in the theater, generous to her colleagues, devoted to the theater.
How'd you get to know her in the first place?
I think, I'm pretty sure I met her. I've often wondered that. I'm pretty sure I met her through Andre Bishop. Just to explain, Andre was someone I went to Harvard with. He was not a close friend, but an acquaintance. It was a year ahead of me and was peripherally involved in the Harvard Theater. Right. And would grow up to be a producer, of course, now is, for some years, run Lincoln Center.
Right.
But at the very beginning of his career, he ran Playwrights Horizons.
Right.
And one of Wendy's first plays, not her first, but an early play, was produced there. And I think it was even before I was a drama critic. And I went to the opening night, I think because Andre must have invited me, and I think that's how I met her.
Huh.
And but I'm not quite sure. But we had other. Also, she wrote sometimes with Christopher Durang, who had also been at Harvard with me, whom I didn't know well. But it's just it's something in the late 70s. It's just sort of a bit foggy. but you know, she, you know, it's been a number of years now since her tragic death. But she, you know, I still very much feel very much surrounded by her aura. And for one thing, she had nephews and a niece, her brother Bruce's children, who were contemporaneous with my kids and went to school with them. And I would see them through that context as well. And one of them, Ben Wasserstein, is actually an executive at HBO who a couple of years ago started working on Veep from the HBO side. And her last assistant, as it happened, her last assistant at the time of her death, who literally was as much caregiver as assistant right up until her last opening, a play called Third at the Mincy Newhouse, which was the last time I saw her, was the opening of that play, saw her alive.
Mm.
Her assistant was a young guy just out of Yale named Jeremy Strong, who was actually a star by coincidence, but a star of became an actor and a star of Succession, a television show I produced.
Yeah.
Yes.
A brilliant young actor.
Wow.
And I hadn't seen him until we cast him. And at first I wasn't even sure it was the same person.
Really?
Cause I remembered him mainly as this kid, Jeremy, not with a last name.
Yeah.
And so anyway, yeah, so she's very much around me. And actually, her niece, Pam Wasserstein, is the CEO of New York Magazine. So, right.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that, Rich. Thank you.
Keep it in that circle. That's marvelous. What was the most surreal experience that you had while being a critic at the New York Times? It seems like a very heady job to have.
It is and it isn't. It is work. You know, it is work under deadline pressure. And a lot of it can be very, you know, it was exhausting. Particularly if you're doing, at the height of the season, doing four shows a week and, you know, writing on deadline, not the night of anymore by the time I did it, but still within 24 hours and then going to the next play. I would say the most surreal, you know, were weird things that just happened. One was, of course, the opening of 42nd Street, where really no one saw it coming that Merrick was going to announce Coward Champion's death
right.
mm-hmm. on opening night. I've seen there was a very unsuccessful play. I think it ran one night, maybe, called Teaneck Tansy.
Yes.
I'll never forget the critics' performance I was at, because Andy Kaufman, the comic, played a kind of boxing promoter, and it was an environmental setting on Broadway. When you arrived, he was like roaming the audience and making wisecracks. And one of my older colleagues, the drama critic colleagues, having no idea who Andy Kaufman was, or that he was a comic provocateur, practically got into a fist fight with him before the show started. That was wow. Things like that. You came to treasure. You'd see critics arrive drunk. Oh. You'd see people fall asleep.
Oh my God!
You know, all those kinds of things. Made, but often it was not that romantic. You know, but people should understand. In my day and now, you don't go on opening nights, and so it is. It's not some Klieg-like exciting experience. 42nd Street was an exception because Merrick canceled all the previews to force the critics to go opening night, but that was a very rare exception.
Wow.
And so it's, you know, it is a job, an enjoyable job at its best, but it is, you know, it's a job like any other in a way. It's just, it's a wonderful job if you love the theater, but it is surreal. Not that often, you know, and even, you know, the biggest failures, Moose Murders was an exception because literally someone covered in vomit was sitting in front of me and Wendy when I was reviewing it, and we had to move our seats.
What?
But even that, I wouldn't call that surreal. I would just call that bizarre.
Tragic. Yeah, totally.
Tragic and bizarre.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, but otherwise, you know, it's work. And
yeah.
I've recently been spending a fair amount of time in London on Succession, going back and forth a bit in pre-production on it. And as I walk through the West End, what I remember so vividly is in the days before you could file electronically, going over to London and seeing, you know, 10 plays in 7 days, filing reviews of them, sometimes having to dictate those reviews on phone to New York, to the Times in New York, at weird hours from phone booths. It was hard.
That's
it
wild.
Was hard work.
Yeah.
You know? Tremendous. It's nice to be a little bit more carefree and not have to see everything or write about it, you know? So.
Yeah, true. You know, you do so many things outside of the theater world now. You've got your, you know, working in a lot of television with Veep, and you've the amazing political essays you do for New York Magazine, which I love. But how has being this sort of what we call quote unquote theater nut, has that helped or informed your career now that it's not in musical
Absolutely.
Theater?
Absolutely.
And how?
Absolutely. When people, yes, I mean, it, first of all, it informed my career as a political journalist because I think that growing up in Washington, and I grew up in the city of Washington, beginning at around age 9, we moved from the Maryland suburbs into the city. And I went to public schools in D.C.
Right.
I was very, as I was falling in love with the theater, I was extremely conscious of the fact that there was an onstage and backstage to Washington, that there were all these glamorous sets, the Capitol, the White House, you know, the Supreme Court, the National Archives, that were tour buses of kids my age came and saw them, but they didn't see the other Washington that I saw living there as a native, which was a segregated city with extremes of poverty, with people living in alleys that would explode right after I graduated high school, you know, in the riots in 1968. Mm. And so I was very conscious. It sort of informed my idea of politics, which is that whatever's happening in front of you is probably not what's actually happening. Huh. And the one book I wrote about politics, The Greatest Story Ever Sold, was about essentially have the Bush administration use showmanship and PR and lying to sell the war in Iraq as a kind of show, and it's very much, and meanwhile, what was really going on, no weapons of mass destruction, right. No connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, was in the shadows. And indeed, only after I wrote the book did I realize it was almost structured like a Broadway musical, and that the first part of that book ends with Bush mission accomplished spectacle, yep. The aircraft carrier.
Yep.
And the part two of the book opens with that sort of quiet number, but wait a minute, where are the weapons of mass destruction? In terms of actual practical ability, both to reviewing and then to being a producer in television, I learned everything from my days as a ticket taker in Washington.
Wow.
I had an education you could not get today, because today shows, particularly in the commercial theater, they're heavier physically. They don't try out in this way. Changes cannot be put in quickly over a short period of time, visibly in front of an audience. Whereas what I could see was almost every 2 or 3 weeks, because that's how long the runs would be, a show would come in. I could go repeatedly for free, and stand in the back, as I did. To this day, I sort of almost prefer standing in the back of a proscenium house to watch a show. And I would see the show come in, and then I'd see people work on it. And I'd see changes go in every other night. And it was absolutely an incredible education, because you'd see a classic example was The Odd Couple. The Odd Couple opened in Washington. It was the last stop before New York. It got great reviews in Washington. It was an immediate hit. But I didn't know them, but I saw Neil Simon and Mike Nichols come in every night and continue to work on the show. And, they kept changing things. They kept, at one point, they never could figure out what to do with the Pigeon Sisters in the second act. At one point, they were not in the second act. By the time it was ending in Washington, they figured out the ending of the play where Felix would go and move in with them. Mm-hmm. But that literally was thrown in the last night. I saw Hello Dolly, which was also an immediate hit in Washington.
Yeah.
I saw American Champion work on it and take a number out that was a Davy Burns production number, A Penny in My Pocket.
Yep.
Recently turned up in another context, pointlessly in my view, in the new revival, and replace it the last weekend with Before the Parade Passes By, when they didn't even have any costumes or sets built for it yet. I saw Jerry Robbins with Fiddler constantly tweak a show that also, again, was very strong and didn't think it needed fixing. It was audiences loved it, the Washington critics loved it, but he put in Anna Tefka in Washington in place of a much lesser song. He took one song away from one character who couldn't sing it and gave it to an actor who could, even if it was nonsensical. the song Now I Have Everything was originally sung by Muddle. It was given to Bert Convy, who could sing it as Perchik, and they got another. They wrote Miracle of Miracles for that Austin Pendleton could sing as Muddle. They and Robbins also called in the cast every non-matinee day to try to create a dance for the second act, and never did. There's no choreography except for that little piece of Havala.
Yeah.
Then I saw things like Mr. President, which was before I was a ticket taker, but I went to see it repeatedly. It was a huge sellout before it opened. Kennedy went to the opening in Washington.
Yeah.
It was the return of Irving Berlin for the first time in a decade after Call Me Madam, and it was Josh Logan and Lindsay and Krauss, and it was inert, and even as an 11 or 12-year-old, I could see that, but I watched these brilliant theater people come in every night and move things around and rewrite and try to change it to no avail.
No.
So all of that I am channeled in without question into my work you know, in television.
Fantastic.
You know, and trying to look at, you know, part of a producer's role is to look at what, look at scripts, look at scenes, look right. at cuts, what's working, what isn't working, what can you contribute to this discussion that might make it better, what, you know, what can't be improved, what could be improved, what casting went astray, all of that.
Yeah.
So I learned it all there. I learned it all as a teenager, basically.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Frank, thank you so much for spending so much time with us. And on a personal
delighted
note.
Delighted to do it. Thanks again for your patience with me. And thanks for doing this. And I look forward not to hearing myself, but to hearing hearing others.
And very quickly on a personal note, I must say that I was living in Los Angeles and I was in high school when Ghostlight came out. And it really changed my life.
Oh, that's so kind of you.
Yeah. Well, no, it's so kind of you. And now that I teach, I make it required reading for my freshman class. I just want you to know
thank
your stories
you.
Are continuing. Thank you. And thank,
thank
you,
you very much. Good luck to you. And thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Frank. Take care.
You too.
Today's episode was recorded at Shetler Studios on 244 West 54th Street. Visit Shetler Studios to book your room today, and you could be as cool as us. That's S-H-E-T-L-E-R studios.com.
And a big thanks to our sound editor, Daniel Schwartzberg, and social media manager, Bethany Ann Selecki.
And friends, don't forget, we want more folks to hear these incredible stories, and that's where you guys can come in and help us out.
Yes, in order for people to find out about us, we need lots of ratings on iTunes. The more ratings, the more they'll come up in searches. So head on over to iTunes, search for Behind the Curtain Broadway's Living Legends, click on our logo, click on ratings and reviews, then write a review and leave us 5 stars and make us feel as special as Eliza Doolittle on Eliza Doolittle Day.
Or you can leave us 1 star and make us feel as bad as Annie did in that weird production in Boston where Annie dreamed about being adopted and then ended the show back in the orphanage. True story, Rob was there.
I saw it. So head on over to iTunes and make us feel even more special than we already do.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.